As I think most of you know, for the last several years, Bob Kagan has been working in Brussels, continuing his work as a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment, as well as serving as a transatlantic fellow for the German Marshall Fund. His time in Brussels is coming to an end, and he's coming back to Washington this summer, and as a kind of arrival present, he's published this new book, The Return of History and the End of Dreams. Now, the title of the book may make you think that it's a diary of what his return to Washington is going to be like. but in fact, it's a broader analysis of the state of the world. Now, as I think many of you know, Bob writes two kinds of books. He writes very long books. His book on Nicaragua, you will remember, clocked in at just over 900 pages. Dangerous Nation came in at over 500 pages, and Bob was just clearing his throat on the 18th and 19th century before he says what he really has to say about the 20th century. And he also writes short books, like A Power in Paradise, which came in at just over 100 pages, and this book is of similar length. I used to wonder about this pattern on Bob's part of short and long books, and I thought maybe there was something physiological about it. but I've come to understand, actually, the method is, in fact, this interspersing of long and short is something different. As you know, Bob is deeply preoccupied with the tension in U.S. foreign policy between realism and idealism, and I've come to see that he's embodying this very dichotomy in his books. His long books are idealist ventures rooted in the charming and stirring faith that Americans are willing to read over 900 pages in Nicaragua. His shorter books are realist ventures based on the reality of what actually sells in the U.S. book market. Long or short, however, his books have some common characteristics. To start with, they're extraordinarily well-written. Bob's writing has an elegance of style, which is actually quite rare in the foreign policy domain, as well as in American letters generally. And this elegance, for me at least, I think is a real pleasure to encounter, and it's also quite disarming. And more than one person has said to me, particularly when they read of Paradise and Power, there's something unfair about Bob. He says, why is it that after reading Paradise and Power, it feels so good to read a book I disagree with so much? These books are also marked by a really notable analytic rigor. As someone who admires a good analytic structure, I'm always struck that Bob mounts an analytic argument in a very systematic and methodical way. Bob has the affable character of the guy next to you on a bar stool, but in his mind, there's the cold rigor of the austere lawyer. Bob's books take on big questions and provide, I think, powerful and original insights about them. He's attracted to big questions, not out of the instinctive ambition so common in the Washington world, but because I think Bob deeply cares about this country and about the state of the world. There is a sincerity to his writing that is almost as out of fashion, yet also as admirable as the elegance of his style. I've had a look at this new book. Fortunately, it's one of the short ones. I read it cover to cover on the Red Line this morning on the way to work. and I can say that it embodies all of these qualities and more. So, Bob, let me conclude with a few simple thoughts. We're proud of your latest accomplishment. We hope your work gets the wide hearing it deserves. And we look forward to having you back here starting this summer. And we hope this new period for you in Washington will not be the end of dreams, but the start of new ones leading to new writing and more outstanding books.
Thank you very much.
Do you have anything to add to that?
I don't really. I too read it on the Red Line between Woodley Park and DuPont Circle. Squeezed it in there. In fact, I read all your books on the Red Line. Usually leave them on the Red Line. As you were talking, it was occurring to me, not only do Bob's books alternate between the long and the short, but his interlocutors also alternate for the big, thoughtful books. He gets Tom Friedman, and for the short books, he gets me. My next door neighbor is Tom. Both at work, we have it's Tom, me, and Maureen Dowd, what I call Ego Alley. And I have deep resentments of Tom for his success. But I notice, I'll just tell one quick story. Tom is not only my neighbor at work, he's my neighbor in Bethesda. And his house is somewhat larger than mine. And one day I was driving by with my then 14-year-old son, and he pointed to Tom's house and said, "Same job, Dad, same job." So I noticed Tom interviewed Bob for his last book, but this is obviously a slighter work, so I'm doing it. And I'm going to start with a question which I hope to annoy Bob with. It comes from the fact that I not only was reading this book recently, I read a book from a mutual friend or associate of ours, Fareed Zakaria, who also has a new book out. And these are entirely different worldviews. Fareed emphasizes the power of economics and technology in particular, sort of the Davos world. And Bob emphasizes a different world. And I was wondering first if you had thoughts, because these really underlie, I think, different worldviews, if you had thoughts about this contrasting way of looking at global affairs and foreign policy.
Well, I do. And, of course, you know, among the many great weaknesses of this book is it isn't a discussion of economics. I'm clearly emphasizing other things. I mean, I do feel that there's a certain tendency these days for people writing about foreign policy to look at the world as a collection of hedge fund opportunities and not really thinking about some of the enduring factors that make human beings do what they do. There's this tendency to just view every nation as a kind of economic maximizer. So if you want to understand what China's doing, you figure out what they need to do in order to continue their economic success. And assume that they will therefore do it. And this is applied all across the globe. And, you know, this is very much, I would say, part of the post-Cold War dream mentality, that we had departed from the long centuries-old era of geopolitics and entered the age, as Martin Walker said, of geoeconomics, where what mattered was your capacity. And I would say, you know, our friend Tom strengthened this notion to suggest that globalization, economic globalization, had become a kind of law that determined all the behavior of nations. But I think what we're seeing in the return of history is the continuing potency of other motives for human action, things like honor, resentment. If you look at Russian policy today, you can't explain Russian policy purely as a matter of economic maximization. There's all kinds of things that they're doing to make money and maximize their economic potential. There's a lot of things they're not doing. And there's a lot of things that they do that has nothing to do with that and has a great deal to do with pride and honor. And so when, for the first time since 1990, you have a military parade at the inauguration of a new president where you've got all the tanks flowing by and the missile launchers, and people interviewed on the streets are saying, yeah, that's our Russia, you know. So there's that's important. And then there's the factor of beliefs. You know, we're all focused on the fact that there are certain people willing to die for some vision of an afterlife or what how the religious situation should be. So there's obviously religious motives for fighting, but there are others as well, other kinds of beliefs that people are willing to fight for. And that's the second element of, you know, why we're, I think, back in history where, you know, Frank and Fukuyama and I may disagree. I think that just because communism is gone doesn't mean that there is no other way of thinking about how to govern a country other than liberal democracy. And I think we're seeing in China and Russia not only that there are autocrats, but the autocrats who believe in autocracy. So I take the obvious point. It's always been the case that economics are critical to international relations, but I think we've just lost sight of all the other issues that make people do what they do.
Now, before we get to the actual thing you're describing is evolving in the world, I still want to stay on this point. One of the significant pages of this book is the dedication page where you dedicate it to your father, and I'm sure most people in this room know that Bob's father, Donald Kagan, is a great historian of the Peloponnesian War and ancient Greece, and one of the things he talks about, and you talk about in the book, is the thymotic urge, the urge for dignity, honor, glory, if you want to put it that way. And I was wondering if you could describe how you think that manifests itself in nations. Do people feel they want to live in a great nation, or is it something that great leaders or leaders want to realize for themselves? How exactly does this urge, which you talk about in the book, drive a nation's foreign policy?
Well, you know, the nation that I've spent the most time studying and feel I know the best is the United States. And since the United States is the country that Americans think is least motivated by things like Thumos, I would like to suggest that it is, in fact, heavily motivated by all the things that you described. the ambition of America to be a great power, a great world force, goes back to the very beginning when our, you know, the founding generation talked about America as a Hercules in the cradle, and really expected that the United States would be. And this is at a time when, you know, we're kind of pitiful group of newly formed states with much bigger empires around the world, but this anticipation. And I would say that this sense of honor, which is closely tied to ideals as well, because it was not only, at least as Americans told themselves, it was not only we as Americans, but we as the holders of a special truth about human existence, you know, the principles of the Declaration of Independence. Our honor, our sense of honor and our sense of idealism was tied up. And if you just look through the whole strain of human history, of American history, with very few periods when this wasn't true, you know, Dean Acheson said the United States, in the grand sweep of civilization, the United States is the locomotive and the rest of the world is the caboose. And I think that sense has always has driven the United States. And it clearly drives other nations as well. Certainly, and it's interesting because many of the emerging great powers today have one thing in common, a sense that in the past they enjoyed enormous significance and success. China's early imperial, you know, when it was a great empire and the center of the universe and its universe. India has a memory of that. Iran has the memory of the Persian Empire. Islam, as a, in a broader sense, has a memory of being a dominant force in the world. And then the part of the narrative is they were there, then they were oppressed, subjugated, humiliated, colonized, penetrated. And now they have a chance to regain that position. And if you read, you know, even the most sort of hard-headed Indian strategic thinkers, it's amazing how much of this sense that India will take its place in the world again. China is overcoming its century of humiliation. Islam needs to restore itself to it, to its rightful place. I mean, these are powerful. This is about Thumos. And I think it's a very big factor in the behavior of nations right now.
Okay. Well, now we should get to the core of your argument. There are a series of views of how the world is evolving. There's the convergence paradigm, which is we're all being brought together by information flows and global economics. There's a theory that we're moving beyond nation states, that we face a series of amorphous threats, global warming, global poverty, terrorism. But what you're describing is very different. So why don't you get to the core of what the argument is?
Well, the core of the argument is that the convergence idea, which I think was very predominant right after the end of the Cold War, and Frank, you know, I think we were all attracted to some extent to Frank Fukuyama's argument. It seemed right. But there was convergence both of ideals and principles, including economic principles. And there was convergence of interests, because if you were not in a period of great power competition anymore and the Cold War was over, people started talking more and more about international community. I think that phrase had been used prior in earlier times in history, but it really became the big phrase of the 1990s, the international community. I wonder whether we really can talk about an international community with the same confidence today, because it seems to me that an international community does depend on, at least in a broad sense, a commonality of broad interests and a commonality of morality, a commonality of principles. Otherwise you're a collection of states bargaining, which is something we've seen before, but you're not an international community. And I think that we, in fact, have a fractured international community. We have a roughly speaking community of democratic nations, and often when we use the term international community, that's kind of what we mean. The international community needs to do something about Burma, but China doesn't want the international community to intervene in Burma without Burma's permission, even if the international community of democratic nations decides it wants to do that. So. What we have, therefore, is the diverging interests that necessarily come from growing great power competition and diverging perspectives on how do you look at the world. And I think that it's easy to lose sight of the fact that even if autocracy is not an ideology like communism, we're not heading into the Cold War, they're not trying to spread them, there's no autocracy international. But autocrats do view the world through the perspective of an autocrat. And autocrats' interests are different than a democratic leader's interest because their power is based on something different. So when Moscow and Beijing, when we look at the color revolutions, let's say, in Georgia and Ukraine, we in the democratic world just say, that's wonderful. It's just the natural unfolding of human potential, finally achieving the progress that everybody should achieve. And when we're almost unconscious of our role in promoting it. But viewed from the perspective of Beijing and Moscow, these are acts of geopolitical aggression because they see a link between our promotion of democratic change and our geopolitical interests at the expense of their geopolitical interests, which is why Putin talks so much, and it almost makes no sense to us when we hear it, about not allowing to happen in Russia what happened in Ukraine, not letting, as he said, the jackals in our society run off to Western embassies. I think we're wrong to assume that he's not in some degree worried that this dominant Western liberal culture will in fact infect and undermine his ability to do what he thinks he needs to do in Russia. And so that is an era of divergence when that reality holds.
Right. And just to be clear, what you're describing, the return to history in the title, is a return to a 19th century system where great power rivalry is the central dynamic.
Well, I don't want to over, you know, I probably have in the interest of writing this in a time that you can read between Woodley Park and DuPont Circle, there's always the danger of over, I'm not saying we're going back to the 19th century. I mean return of history in the sense that Frank meant the end of history, first of all, because he didn't mean that the history would end in a literal sense. He meant that the ideological struggle was over. I think that we are back to not the 20th century style of struggle between various types of fascism and totalitarianism and democracy, but in the 19th century, there was an ongoing competition between mostly Eastern autocratic governments and mostly Western liberal governments. And I think we're more back to that kind of world and more back to a world where it's neither two superpowers arranging everything or is it one, that the unipolar moment where there is a superpower and no other great powers. I mean, that's the condition that was so, that created such an illusion in our minds that there was a brief moment after the Cold War when it wasn't only that the Soviet Union had collapsed. There were no really great powers out there. If you think about it, you go around the world, Russia was on its back, obviously. China had just had Tiananmen Square and was in a kind of defensive crouch and had certainly not emerged on the scene the way it subsequently would. India had yet to begin its economic takeoff. Japan had just entered a decade of severe economic contraction. And so the EU is now becoming a postmodern power, is moving off in an entirely different direction. And so the only sort of traditional great power standing was the United States. And I think we took that as maybe this is the new norm. Realists reminded us, people like Henry Kissinger said, no, that's not going to stay this way. And they were right. And what we've seen, I think, is an inevitable return of great powers to the point where we have now what the Chinese strategists tend to describe as one superpower, many great powers, which I think is what we're likely to have for a while.
But the difference between you and a lot of people is the way you describe the nature of the relationship between the different powers.
Yes.
A lot of people would say, fine, we're in a multipolar world. Great powers agree on some things, don't agree on others. They negotiate their way to common solutions. You describe a much more rivalrous or even hostile world between the great powers.
Well, I don't think that it's not possible for even nations that are engaged in rivals with one another not to work things out. I mean, whether people work things out is another issue. But is there geopolitical competition going on? Yes, and I think it's very hard to ignore, although we somehow managed to ignore it. India and China are clearly engaged in some degree of competition for what are overlapping spheres of influence as they perceive them. I mean, when Hu Jintao visits the Seychelles or someplace, the Indian government registers a protest because the Indian perception is that they should be a dominant power in the Indian Ocean and in the subcontinent more generally. They have overlapping spheres of influence. China and Japan are a natural rivalry. They can go through periods like they are now with the Fukuda government of warming things up, but that rivalry goes back hundreds of years. Does it mean they're going to war tomorrow? No. But is that rivalry a factor in international relations? Certainly. And the United States, of course, itself is a traditional great power in the sense that I think we have good reasons for not wanting to depart East Asia or depart the Middle East, but I also think that our sense of ourselves as a great power means that we shouldn't just, you know, just recede and let China become the dominant power of Asia.
Right. And but how you judge your level of hostility or level of in contradiction with other nations determines your policy. And one of the nations you spend a lot of time on in the book is Russia. And John McCain, who just gave a speech, a part of which raised eyebrows, it's a little simplistic to say he wants to kick Russia out of the G8. But there is an element in that speech, which you may have had something to do with, and an element in this book that we're inevitably going to be involved in cold and potentially hostile relationships with Russia, and therefore we should be extremely tough and to push them away as much as possible.
Well, I don't say that in the book, and I don't think John McCain says that in his speech, and nobody's kicking Russia out of the G8, so, you know, that's... But Russia is a problem, and it's a problem for Europe in the first instance. And we're seeing that problem emerge. Now, this doesn't mean, A, that the problem is insoluble. It doesn't mean that we need to come to blows. I do not think we should, you know, set up a new Cold War. And we're going to be in a world like the 19th century, but even to some extent like the 20th century, where our relations with nations operate on many planes. You know, the very sort of neat Cold War division between the United States and the Soviet Union, where you basically didn't trade with each other and maybe often you didn't talk to each other, that, I think, is an aberration in international affairs. Most of the time, I mean, you know, for what it's worth, England and Germany were, just a couple of years before World War I, were thinking, maybe we should have an alliance. I mean, it's not like it's all just heading toward war and you march forward. I mean, there's a lot of give and take, and there's going to be that in the U.S. and European relations with Russia. But we are seeing right now the tensions where overlapping great power perception, especially by Russia, and the ideological divide are producing tensions in a place like Georgia. What is the conflict in Georgia about? I mean, at the end of the day, for the Russians and for Europeans, it's not about Abkhazia. It's about the fact that Georgia is in what Russia perceives, and this is even more true of Ukraine, of being at the very least in its sphere of influence and at the very most under its sphere of dominance. It also is a nation that, after the Rose Revolution, clearly broke away from the Moscow direction and sought the embrace of Europe and the United States. And this is something that Putin considers a very bad setback. He also considered events in Ukraine to be a setback for him. And so, you know, we can't ignore the problem. And sometimes I think that on our side, we're the only ones who don't realize that this competition exists. But the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, says we're in an international competition of ideas about development. And the West, he happily says, no longer has a monopoly on this. And multipolarity means not just multi-power, but multiple ideas. And so I think that, you know, what to do about it is another question. But I do think that on an issue like Kosovo, where the United States and Europe pretty much stuck together, Russia ultimately backed down. I think that, you know, Putin's actions are more opportunistic than essential, and therefore it would make sense for the West to be fairly united. And I think he will deal, you know, since so much of this for Putin is about honor as opposed to vital interest, I think we could figure out ways to provide the honor without conceding other countries to Russian control.
Well, there are two elements here you've talked about. One is the national honor. The other is the belief system that surrounds autocracy.
Yeah.
How do you tease out the difference between them?
Well, it's interesting that for Putin, the concept of sovereign democracy, I think, sort of neatly ties together the perception of Russia returning as a great power and the need for a very strong central government in Russia, as opposed to the chaos, as he would put it, the 1990s. I mean, from the Russia perspective, I was talking about the century of humiliation. For Russia, it's the decade of humiliation. The post-Cold War period when Russia, and now in the view of Putin and people who support him, was on its back to the West. It was sort of, you know, the West destroyed it, took everything, pushed it back strategically. And this is linked in Putin's narrative with the fact that Russia was trying to democratize. And so it all comes together. And what he wants is a Russia that is strong enough to protect its sovereign independence from the depredations of these Western powers that want to come in and infiltrate it. But that means not permitting the West to impose its version of how government should be run. And I think that he believes, as, you know, monarchs and czars in the past believed, that it is not only in his interest to remain in power. In fact, from what I gather, he'd rather go live in, maybe rather go live in a dacha or live in a villa in Italy. But Russia needs him to be this strong. And that's why he can't give up power now, because Russia needs him to keep this firm grip on things. And so in a way, we're so caught up in communism as the only alternative ideology. Autocracy is not an ideology, but I think these autocrats believe in autocracy. And I think the Chinese also think that it's not in the interest of China for them to give up power.
And are other nations going to look at the success of China and economically Russia and think, pretty good model?
Well, that's the question. I mean, how attractive is the model? I mean, here's what I don't think it's as simple as that. You know, it's not like a country will say, maybe we should be like that. But although I could imagine certain leaders faced with the choice of whether they ought to, whether the only choice really is to put on some semblance of democratic form, or maybe you can get away with this other thing and not do that. Right. I think the success of Russia and China may affect those kinds of calculations. I mean, if you were a leader in the 1990s, you might have said, "This, whatever I might want to do, autocracy is a bad bet. We may not be allowed to do it. It doesn't look like a successful economic. It won't work. You know, you can't." And then if everybody believed the iron logic that if I need to grow economically, I can't even sustain an autocracy. Well, now there is this alternative option to look at, at least. But I think, you know, if you think back on different times in history, the global balance of ideology or of regime type at the top level does have an effect on the choices, I think. I don't know whether, I mean, I sit here in front of Tom Carruthers, who probably could go through every single instance of whether this is true or not, but I just have a sense that, you know, when fascism was in vogue in Europe, you had all these little fascist dictatorships popping up in Latin America all of a sudden. When communism seemed successful, you know, it isn't the case that Soviet Union went around trying to plant communism everywhere. It was more of a copycat situation. People started running on a communist banner. When the democracies sort of did their big push toward success in the 80s and then culminating in 89, you had a kind of flowering of democracy. Now, there are other things going on. I agree with that. But I do think it matters. So if you now are in a situation where two of the strongest powers in the world are autocracies, I think it would be surprising if that didn't have some effect on the direction, you know, maybe at the margins, that the rest of the world took.
Okay. Now, I want to get to how the U.S. should respond to this circumstance, but just to throw in another of the big regional powers on autocracies, Iran. Is Iran just another regional autocracy or nationalistic, pride-oriented, history-aggrieved regional autocracy, or does the Islamic element add another piece that is different than the others?
No, it adds another piece, and but I think it's all, in a way, I wonder whether it's all balled up together, whether the memory of ancient glory, the perception that that Persians have that they should be a dominant player in the region, combined with the perception that they are also the leaders of the only true faith, is a very potent mix. And it seems to me that is what fuels, among other things. I mean, you know, you go around the world, there are a lot of countries who don't think they should be ruling anything. You know, I mean, Belgium does not anymore. It did at one time, but Belgium does not anymore think that it should be, you know, a great power. That's
even
not
even ruling itself.
Right. Well, that's another matter. But some countries and different countries at different times in history do have that perception. The United States has, I think, always had that perception. And I think Iran has that perception now. And that affects decisions that are otherwise not necessarily easily explained.
Yeah, I'm going to go to questions from the floor in a second. But just let's finally now turn to what the U.S. response should be. We had a foreign policy model in the Cold War. How was the U.S. response different, or how should it be different?
Well, I mean, part of it is, I would say, at the beginning is just recognition that these factors need to be accounted for, and to stop thinking as if we live in a convergence era, and it's really just a matter of how you organize the concert of nations. I mean, there are still people recommending that we just get a whole concert of nations together to run things, and I just think that's hard to do given that reality. I think that there is no avoiding the competition between autocracy and democracy. So when people say, well, we'll start a new Cold War, the divisions exist. And the question, to my mind, is, are we going to basically hold up our end of the competition, by which I mean nothing necessarily more dramatic than having greater democratic solidarity. I wonder whether the rise of these autocracies will, over time, tend to throw the democracies back upon one another, whether they like it or not, whether there will be greater ability to cooperate, for instance, in the transatlantic relationship, even if we are still on Mars and Venus, as I think we are. And I wonder whether the current trend in Europe, which is sort of surprising, of relatively pro-American leaders replacing those who were more interested in multipolarity, whether there is in that a reflection already of this shifting instance. But I think for the United States, in addition to thinking about the global issues that we need to think about, I think we also need to start taking democracy seriously and stop assuming, as I think we did, that all you have to do is sort of lie back and democratic progress will sort of flow forward naturally. I mean, I still am amazed to hear, Frank and I were just having this discussion, you know, when China hits $8,000 GDP, that we just need to sit around and wait for that to happen, then they'll become a democracy. And I just think that I'm not so sure that that isn't one of the dreams we have to give up on.
And what are the implications for international organizations of this, these sorts of rivalries?
Well, I mean, we've already seen one implication. I think the UN, it's like, you know, the UN Security Council is a little like the movie Awakening. You know, it was in a coma throughout the entire Cold War. Then for a brief shining moment, at the end of the Cold War, it woke up and it looked like all of a sudden it could do what it was originally planned to do but never could do. I think it has now fallen, unfortunately, the drugs have wore off and it's fallen back into the coma because while it's still possible to get some, you know, lowest common denominator agreement on these issues, the bottom line is that on almost every major issue, you have a clear lineup with Russia and China on one side, China usually hiding behind Russia, and the United States, France, and the UK on the other. And I think a lot of these issues have to do precisely with issues of sovereignty, with the liberal democratic countries pushing for diminution of sovereignty, and sort of ironically, Russia and China sticking up for very traditional Westphalian principles of sovereignty. I mean, we're the revolutionaries in this situation. It's the Democrat, not just the United States, it's the democratic countries that are seeking change in international law. There's no international tradition that I'm aware of the responsibility to protect, which gives others the right to intervene if they choose to do so. And China and Russia are saying, no, let's go back to the original principles that you Europeans invented, they might point out.
Right. And in some ways, it's what you're describing is sort of a grim picture of the next period. But the happy undertone is the U.S. has a more popular role, at least in the democratic world. There's an interesting section in the book on how whether we should worry about America's unpopularity in the world or just how we should think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the United States needs to do a great deal to repair the damage that's been done to its reputation. And I think that means going back to something that we gave up on, I think deliberately at the end of the Cold, not at the end of the Cold War, but at the end of the Clinton administration, when the Bush administration came in, which was this notion that we need to define our interests extremely broadly, that we need to define them beyond any sort of narrow perception of what interest is and encompass the interests of many others, and particularly other democracies. The Bush administration came in with a kind of really narrow realism, and we were going to examine every issue, every treaty, according to whether it served our narrow national interests. And Gene Kirkpatrick, that great neoconservative, you know, sort of famously said that now that the Cold War was over, we can go back to being a normal nation. We can unload the burdens of leadership. Well, one of unloading the burdens of leadership was you don't have to make these compromises and deals with everybody anymore. I think we need to go back to that. I think you have to offer people some reason to have allegiance with you other than that you claim you're fighting for the good. I mean, that's a nice idea, but it's not enough. It's going to be hard because, you know, the Europeans put up with a tremendous amount of unpleasantness in the United States for decades during the Cold War because they were dependent on the United States for their very security. They believed they were dependent. I mean, when you think about the America that existed between 1968 and 1974, that was not a lovable America. I mean, not only was there a Vietnam War, there was the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, the Watts riots, Nixon, Watergate. Nixon's America was not beloved in the world. But it didn't produce a transatlantic crisis because the Europeans felt dependent on the United States. A Europe that no longer feels dependent on the United States is much less forgiving of an America that's behaving badly in their eyes or in fact is behaving badly. So we're going to have to restore some perception of interest. Now, this may happen whether we try to or not, and this is the long way of answering your question. I mean, if democracies begin to worry that the autocracies are getting a leg up, that may throw us together and provide the kind of common interest that can hold us together. Although, right now, I would say Europe has not made that decision by any means.
Okay, now there are a lot of people in this room who I see know a lot about this, and I'm going to go to questions. I'm just going to ask one final one, which is to end where I began, to give Fareed his due. There is this fact of an incredibly growing global economy.
Yep.
There is the fact of global communications. In some ways, nation-states becoming less powerful. How does that element, which Fareed writes about and Tom, God knows, writes about, how does it change the power dynamics that in ways that are different from the 19th century?
Well, I mean, there's reason to hope that, the greater mutual dependence and interdependence of our economies is a check on other on normal geopolitical conflict. I mean, you could hope that because the Chinese hold X dollars of our treasury bonds and we are dependent on their market, et cetera, that is. And I'm sure that to some extent that is a check and it is a major calculation that the Chinese make. I just don't want us to assume that it's enough. And that's all there is, because it is also true that every single day the Chinese prepare for a possible war over Taiwan, a war they do not want. But they won't be the first, we wouldn't be the first countries in the world who wound up in a conflict that we didn't want and which tremendously damaged our economic relations. England and Germany were highly intertwined economically before World War I. So I believe the changes that Tom and Fareed talk about matter, but I don't think they matter enough for us to sort of blithely move on and not worry about these other developments that I'm trying to emphasize.
Okay. Questions? Let's see. One in the aisle.
Hello, my name is Chantal Lyon-Artard. I'm with the U.S. Institute of Peace. Congratulations, Bob, on
your
new
Chantal.
Book. I wanted to ask you if you could expound a little bit on the idea of the League of Democracies. Should this be a league with a headquarters, a budget, and a staff? And
why,
what
do
exactly?
Do you need a place? Are you looking for a budget?
No, actually, a very nice place. And what should it do? Should it intervene in cases like, for instance, Myanmar, Burma? As you know, Kushner has invoked the idea of responsibility to protect. Would Burma be a good case for the alliance to intervene? And then if that is the case, how could it not undermine the UN?
Well, you know, whether I don't know that it needs to have a at this point even think about a budget and a headquarters and all that kind of stuff. I mean, in fact, you know, at least in my perception of it, the idea is still a fairly modest idea. And by the way, what it would be would depend on what its members wanted it to be. I mean, I would have to say the first thing is this is not going to be, you know, Woodrow Wilson sailing across the Atlantic with 14 points. And trying to convince everybody to sign up. I mean, the only way this... First of all, there will be no League of Democracies unless the major democracies want there to be one. The United States... This is one idea the United States cannot impose on anyone. And secondly, what it should do and what it will depend on the consensus of its members. Now, I would say you don't need a League of Democracies to carry out a you know, an action similar to the responsibility to protect without a UN Security Council resolution. We already had an organization that did that. It's called NATO, which acted in Kosovo as an organization, but without UN Security Council authorization. So if you, you know, you could argue that that diminished the UN Security Council, or you could argue that that's what happens when the UN Security Council is going to be repeatedly stalemated. I guess I think that the one of the virtues of a global group of democracies is that it might, in fact, have greater legitimacy than just NATO acting, because the fact is my, as far as I can recall, much of the rest of the world, even though most of the NATO allies thought they were doing the right thing, most of the rest of the world didn't think that NATO by itself could bestow legitimacy on such an action. So perhaps maybe a more global organization could bestow greater legitimacy on it. You know, it's not that anyone wants to supplant the UN Security Council, but if we are in a situation where the UN Security Council simply cannot act on issues like this, we will either have ad hoc coalitions acting, or we will have nobody acting, or we will have some other kind of institution which at least would have the virtue of providing some broad consensus. I mean, one of the purposes of the League of Democracy, and by the way, you know, as I'm sure most of you know, this idea is actually the brainchild of Democrats and people who consider themselves liberal internationalists, people like John Eikenberry, for instance, who argue that this is another way of embedding the United States within an international framework so that the United States does not go off and do the world does not perceive the United States as going off and doing whatever it wants to do whenever it chooses. And I think that, you know, it is time. We talk a lot about the need for new institutions in a new era. Nothing is more antiquated than the membership of the UN Security Council Permanent Five. And it would be one thing to try to say, well, let's reform it. Let's put India on. Let's put Japan on. Let's put Brazil on. Let's, God forbid, have an EU seat. I'm sorry, I won't go there. But, you know, I think that is never going to happen, because I don't think China will ever permit India or Japan to sit on the Security Council. And I know that the Europeans, you know, for all of their, you know, virtue, are the British and the French are really jealous of their position on the UN Security Council. So it's very hard to get that kind of reform. So the choice for me is not, you know, the League of Democracies because you want to supplant the UN. It's, if the UN isn't going to work, what other methods and institutions are we going to have? But long before, and I'm giving a long answer on League of Democracies because it seems to be a very controversial issue. Long before you get to the question of intervention, why can't you have a League of Democracies that simply meets and discusses the great issues that are facing our time and that we have in common? There are all kinds of organizations in the world. There's an organization of rich nations, there are organizations of poor nations, there's an Islamic conference, there are all kinds of regional organizations. There's organizations to discuss fishery rights. The only thing that there isn't is an organization like, I mean, there is an organization, the Community of Democracies, which doesn't seem to be functioning very well, but there's no real international organization where democracies get together. We have a lot in common. We have a lot of interests in common, and I don't see why we can't at least begin by discussing some of those.
There in the back.
Karim Hagag from the Egyptian Embassy. There seems to be a fundamental question that underlies your argument, and that has to do with the issue of linkage between regime type of any given state and the external behavior of that state. I think the conventional answer to that question would be liberal democracies behave one way and autocracies behave another way. And I wonder, is that the explicit assumption that you're basing your argument on, or is it more nuanced, more complex?
It's more nuanced and more complex. I don't want to say, although it's always been a cardinal principle of both the American sensibility, but really in a broader sense, the Enlightenment sensibility, going back to Montesquieu and Kant, that democracies don't go to war with each other at the very least. And it's always been a kind of prejudice in the American psyche that, you know, dictatorships are the ones that cause war and democracies don't, which is one reason why every time we go to war with some dictatorship, we wind up feeling like we should convert it to a democracy, because that's the problem. is that it was a dictatorship. So that's an old attitude. I'm less interested in that than in simply saying we need to recognize that the one thing we can be confident of is that it is the interest of the autocracy to preserve itself in power. And from that flow certain attitudes towards foreign policy. It doesn't mean autocracies are naturally aggressive and democracies are naturally passive, because anybody who's looked at the United States over the last 200 years could not possibly come to that conclusion. But autocracies do need to act in the interest of preserving their autocracy, which has implications for instance, what is their attitude toward the responsibility to protect? They don't like it, because they don't like the idea of sovereignty being dragged down in a world where liberal governments want to change things. It can mean that, you know, it will regard a revolution on its borders that is a democratic revolution as potentially threatening. There's no question that Russia regarded those revolutions as potentially threatening to them, nor do I think there's any question that China regards, democracies that may develop ties with people in China as a problem for them. So I don't want to go much further than that, but I think that is enough in a way to be an important factor in our understanding how the international system is going to work.
But if I understand your argument, you're not saying the democracies believe one thing and they're sort of on this side and the autocracies are on this side. Autocracies have certain mental traits in common, pretend to, but they also have rivalries with each other.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, as I say in the book, it's not like Russia and China are not in a way more afraid of each other than either one of them are afraid of us. But they're both afraid of democratization.
Right.
And that will cause them to link up sometimes. By the way, the democracies don't behave consistently either, because India these days frequently behaves more like an autocracy, at least in its dealings with a problem like Burma for strategic reasons. South Africa seems to be consistently siding with the autocracies on a lot of issues, which I think has something to do with post-colonial attitudes and a perception that the West is of an imperial West, which has them linking up. One of the virtues I would like to think of a League of Democracies would be to take a country like, say, Indonesia, and put it in a group that is about democracy, rather than perceiving itself as a kind of potential victim of the West, even though it is a democracy.
You're in front.
Thanks. Gary Mitchell from the Mitchell Report. I want to stay on this concert or Congress or whatever it is of democracies thing, because I'll say at the outset that it strikes me as, on the one hand, I get the logic. On the other hand, it seems to me it's almost exactly the last thing we ought to be thinking about or doing now, given the fact that despite this democracy-autocracy split that you're talking about, there has been, arguably, an enormous amount of progress in the relationships, particularly between the United States and Beijing and, to a lesser extent, Russia. So is this a drawing of, is this another sort of drawing a line in the sand, A, B, does it sort of suggest to Moscow and Beijing and whoever else is in that they need a concert of autocracies? Doesn't it in some way exactly doesn't work toward greater cooperation around issues like global warming, AIDS, et cetera, that a common agenda where the autocracies and the democracies have fairly similar interests?
Yeah, that is, it seems to me, the most obvious objection. And, there are a number of ways I'd answer. One is to say we shouldn't kid ourselves that they don't already perceive that this exists. Viewed from Moscow and Beijing, they can see many instances when the democracies have acted together against their interests. I think we forget that what the most upsetting war of the past 10 years from Moscow and Beijing's perspective was not the Iraq War, it was the Kosovo War. It didn't help that we accidentally bombed the Chinese embassy in the course of it, but that only kind of reinforced the Chinese perception that here was the West taking it upon itself, without going to the only duly recognized authority to act, and pursuing its interests by sheer power. So I think they already perceive that this kind of thing exists. And as I say, sometimes I think the only people who don't perceive that it exists is our side. Another question is, you worry about the League of Autocracies. You know, there are those who would suggest there already is a kind of organization of autocracies, that's what the, you know, to some extent, that's what the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is about. And by the way, that's the way the Russians, often the Russian media, portrays it. I've seen it portrayed as an anti-NATO. I've seen it portrayed as a Warsaw Pact II. Now, the Chinese, you know, they don't get into that kind of thing. The Russians sort of love pushing this in our face. The Chinese, because I think they're more optimistic about the future, want to try to keep things on a low boil. In August of 2007, there was a naval exercise in the Bay of Bengal that included the navies of the following countries: the United States, Japan, India, Australia, and Singapore. When the Chinese saw this, they sort of went to every embassy and duly registered their protest, and everybody assured them this had nothing to do with them. But obviously it did. And, you know, the Abe government didn't last very long in Japan, but Abe spoke about an Asian arc of freedom. In fact, I even found in a Chinese press account something that they referred to as the axis of democracy. So, you know, I think that there is always a danger that by formalizing a reality that already exists, you may create greater tension. The question that I would weigh is how much more marginal tension are you creating versus whether you may actually create the solidarity that I think is needed on the Democratic side. And, you know, that's a tough call. And by the way, you may have difficulty, one may have difficulty getting Australia under Kevin Rudd to sign up for it. I think you could have gotten Australia under Howard to sign up for it, you know, and so these things will matter. I would try to focus on in an early stage, not on saying, and here's our League of Democracies, and this is what we're going to do about the autocracies. I would focus on things that shouldn't be troubling to anybody, and to try to get people used to the idea that it doesn't have to be an aggressive organization, and that they shouldn't even perceive it as such necessarily. And finally, you know, not that this should be of any consolation to Vladimir Putin. I mean, clearly the membership of a League of Democracy would be open to those countries that wanted to be democracies. So it doesn't exclude Russia and China per se. It only excludes autocratic Russia and China.
You wrote a column a couple months ago, a very Obama-esque column, if I may say, on why we should talk to Iran. How does that fit into this framework? Is it a model for relations with these various?
That's the thing. There are sort of decisions that are at the tactical level, which are ways of addressing the larger problem which exists. I mean, it was perfectly reasonable for the United States to negotiate with the Soviet Union when there was a real Cold War and there were two armed camps, and yet it made sense to negotiate. I mean, suggesting that the world is, as a matter of fact, divided between autocracies and democracies doesn't further suggest that, therefore, we're now going to build a wall between them, and that's the end of it. So, I mean, every traditional tactic and strategy of foreign policy can be employed, including attempting to work out close relations based on the common interests that we do have, including especially common economic interests. I don't think the two things they're not mutually exclusive. I do agree that there would be some consternation, but it's a funny kind of consternation. It would be a little bit hard to articulate in a way, because the Russians don't even claim not to be a democracy. So it'd be an interesting problem as to how they would word their objection.
Other questions? Fred.
Fred Hyatt from the Washington Post. I want to take it back to economics, because it seems the autocracies don't entirely accept the view of the world, that the world is necessarily going to get flat in Tom's understanding. The Chinese think they can develop their own internet. The Russians want to control their own energy companies. And I'm curious what, you know, when you have a country like the U.S. where corporations are not at least explicitly acting in national interest, and you Russia with Gazprom, and what effect does that have on foreign policy and in in between nations and on the competition?
I mean, clearly, and that's a much more obvious problem for the Europeans than it, right now than it is for us, because Russia does not, in fact, play a fair, balanced game when it comes to economic exchange. And as you rightly say, it's not a flat world from their point of view. The ideal from the Russian point of view is that they have complete control over who invests in what in Russia, while having complete freedom of action in investing and making purchases in Europe. And, you know, the European Union is highly conscious of this problem, and you can't go through a day without some European Union officials saying, we need a common energy security strategy. And yet they seem to be, I would say, almost completely incapable of accomplishing that. And instead, Russia is able to pick off one country or another. And I suppose, you know, this is why people get worried, and I'm told we shouldn't worry about sovereign wealth funds that are run by companies. But we are, you know, we are dealing with a new phenomenon. I mean, if you think about the Cold War, one thing the Soviet Union didn't have was, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to throw around in a free market system where nobody could really stop them from doing that. And we do face that now. I don't know what the answer is. I would like the Europeans in particular to have a common security, a common energy policy, but I'm not very optimistic that they're going to do it. So I guess I don't know what the answer is. But I appreciate your pointing out that this isn't a situation where China and Russia are fully integrated members of what we conceive to be the flat world international economy, but are trying as best they can, and who can blame them, to jigger this in such a way that works to their advantage. And I guess I would love to get some ideas and insights from people who know how we should be responding to that.
Tom Bridle from the National Democratic Institute. And a lot of what you're talking about is are things that we encounter every day in our work, but I want to ask you about something a little bit different, which is kind of the counterfactual, and you just touched on it in the answer to this question, which is that to what extent is the rise of the autocracies to some extent our fault, and specifically, you know, the fault of our policies? Would we be... How worried would we be about Russia if oil were at $30 a barrel? You know, how would Venezuela be an issue if oil were $30 a barrel? Would we be in a different situation if we weren't engaged in Iraq for the past 6 years, which has, I think, really fundamentally undermined a lot of our standing in the world? So I wonder if you could talk about the extent to which this is just a historical development which has taken place inevitably, and to what extent this is something which is a creation of our actions.
Well, I mean, I think is the answer to questions like that is always it's a little of both. But in the case of Russia and China's emergence as great powers seeking to undo certain elements of a past that makes them unhappy, I mean, in Russia, that began before the Iraq War. It began before September 11th. It began before Bush's election. I mean, I would say there have been a number of turning points you could point to. And when you said, isn't it our fault, I thought you were going to talk about some other things, which I think most Russians would point to as being the things that are our fault, like the war in Kosovo and NATO enlargement. I would say most Russians would point to that, not Iraq. Iraq has been a wonderful thing for Putin in the sense that it's given him a chance to go to Munich and say the United States is like Nazi Germany and most of Europe is going like that. So that's obviously been helpful to him, but it doesn't explain Russia's turn. I think Russia's turn has more to do with a perception of, I think, you know, partly a perception of humiliation in the 1990s, partly the failure of democracy. And if you ask me what we did wrong in Russia, if we did anything, it was not being more aggressive in pushing for democracy in Russia and being too tolerant of the unraveling of democracy in Russia. Because this is why, again, you get to the linkage between regime type and regime interests and foreign policy. You know, even though Yeltsin's Russia didn't like the enlargement of NATO and it caused them difficulties, I don't think that Yeltsin would have said, and not even Mikhail Gorbachev described NATO as a threat to Russia. NATO was a lot more frightening in 1985 than it was in 2005. But Putin is the one raising alarm bells and saying, what do they want to do to us? And I think that is not just about military issues. I think it's about political issues. And so you could say we've driven them into this, but they've also driven themselves into it, if you see what I mean. So on the price of oil, I mean, I'm not enough of an expert, but my understanding, insofar as I understand anything, is that there are many factors feeding into the high price of oil, and not the least of which is China is increasing demand. I don't know if you can blame the Iraq War for $120 barrel oil. Maybe you can to some extent. But look, I don't doubt that we have certainly made our situation more difficult, not only by Iraq, but by the way we've managed international relations over the past few years. And whether we can dig ourselves out of this hole, we'll have to see.
Christian Wernicke, I'm working for the German daily Süddeutsche Zeitung here as the correspondent. I haven't read your book yet because I don't go by metro.
You don't take the metro, yeah.
Yeah.
There's books on tape, you know.
I'd like to encourage you to elaborate a little bit more on the prospects of European-American relations, let's say, after January 2009. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of scenarios. I mean, the kind of exaggerated expectations, honeymoon, and then everybody will get sober after 100 days and also. But if you could place this into the context of, in the far more broader context of how you see the world emerging, having worked also quite some years in Brussels, the EU, I know, doesn't really fit into this world which will live in this return of history. I mean, this postmodern concept sounds almost as if bound to failure because it doesn't fit into the world, at least that you are seeing emerging here. Thank you.
Well, those are two different questions, but let me answer the second one first. I mean, I think it is an interesting conundrum for Europe, and I don't believe that Europe can't the EU can't survive. I think the EU will continue to survive and maybe even flourish, but it is a kind of unexpected anomaly that you have this 21st century postmodern entity, the first of its kind, confronting not what was assumed was going to be the case in the 1990s, which is a Russia yearning to be integrated into this liberal order as best as it possibly can, but a Russia that is actively rejecting that kind of integration and wants to assume a position that is not as one among many European countries, but as at least an equal to Europe, and in fact, really an equal to China and the United States. So in a way, you now have a 21st century entity bordering a 19th century style power. And I think it's fair to say that the 21st century entity was not equipped, did not equip itself to deal with this. And you know, you could talk about that in a military fashion, but I think it's even more striking again on the energy fashion. I mean, I don't think Europe thought of itself as likely to be the victim of a country that would be using its energy resources for not only for economic purposes, but for geopolitical purposes. And what is the EU's response to that? I'm not sure that anybody had ever imagined that would happen. And so it's difficult for the EU to be able to deal with it. And I must say, I've lived in Europe for 6 of the last 8 years, and I had 2 periods of living in Europe. One was 2000 to 2003, and then the other was 2005 until this summer. And even at the time when the United States and Europe were at complete loggerheads, and you know it was the Europe of Chirac and Schroeder, it struck. And even when Europe itself was divided in that period, it nevertheless struck me as a very confident Europe, a fairly confident Europe, confident about where it was going, confident about its place in the world. I have to say that the Europe that I see today is much less confident, much less convinced that it has answers to the problems that it sees. And this has to do with, you know, the complexion of its population, but also in terms of dealing with Russia. So I think Europe right now does not know where it wants to go on this issue. And you can see that in the Russia case, too. And the enlargement of the EU has made dealing with Russia so complicated. Because I think if it were up to France and Germany and even the UK, they would say, fine, Russia can have its sphere of influence. That's what the French Prime Minister said, effectively, anyway. But, of course, they have other EU countries who are bordering Russia who have a rather different attitude, and this has kind of paralyzed Europe right now. where are U.S.-European relations going? Again, you know, I think the intense anti-Americanism of recent years is going to fade, and in some respects is already fading. In fact, I'm told that upcoming polls are going to show an uptick in European attitudes, I think almost entirely due to their watching our presidential elections. Now, I don't know whether if the wrong guy wins, Europe is going to still feel that way. I suspect they will be relieved at the next president, no matter who it is. I think that's an easy enough bet to make, which does give the United States an opportunity to try to reconfigure, you know, to reestablish a better relationship. I still think, though, that on some of these key issues, we're going to see things differently. Now, I don't know exactly what a Barack Obama approach to Russia is going to be. I have a clear sense of what Hillary Clinton's approach would be. I have a pretty clear sense of what John McCain's approach was going to be. But if the United States wants to start taking, as we saw at Bucharest, a somewhat tougher line on Russia, I think this is going to throw Europe into a very, you know, uncertain place, as we saw also at Bucharest. And that may be the new tension, in addition to all the other tensions. So that's not a very clear answer to your question, but at least it's a, you know, it's an attempt at a roadmap of where things are going.
Maybe a couple more in the back, and then...
Alex Hall, British Foreign Office. I'm quite struck by how you talk about Russia and China as if they represent the views of their people, whereas the whole point about an autocracy is it doesn't represent the views of its people.
Not necessarily.
And although Putin and Medvedev were elected, were they truly free and fair elections? Were the opposition able to run? Were they able to field their candidates? So is there a middle path where you could say the convergence is happening and there is a trend where were people in these countries allowed to freely express their desires, they would be wishing to converge with a more liberal order? And the whole point about why Beijing and Moscow and others are clamping down on NGOs and the press and tightening is because they fear it. They sense that is what is happening.
No, I mean, look, I agree, but I think that begs the question. If people were allowed to elect their own governments freely, then there would be the convergence. The fact that they're not allowed to do so and that they're not allowed to do so effectively means that there isn't convergence. Now, I would say I would be a little cautious about assuming I know what Russian opinion is. I think right now there is reason to believe that a majority of Russians like what Putin is doing, and they have reason to like lots of parts of it. And even to the point of saying, you know, if here's the bargain that both the Chinese government and the Russian government now are capable of offering because of their economic growth, even though they're for very different reasons. The bargain is you can lead a much freer life, you can be materially better off, you can have a higher standard of living. We are not going to be as China's a little bit more totalitarian. Russia's not going to be that totalitarian. You can have the kind of conversations you want. You can talk about anything you want. Just keep your nose out of politics. And if you get your nose in politics, we cut off your nose. And that's very clear. Now, I think that we shouldn't assume that the Russian people and Chinese people aren't willing to take that bargain for a very long time to come. And even a rising middle class, despite all our modernization theories, with a sufficiently effective autocratic government may not do what we want and expect it to do, which is demand greater freedom. They may put up with it for a long time. And let me just say, I hate to use this word, but I'm a liberal in the truest sense. I believe in progress, and I think that all things being equal, what Frank Fukuyama says is right, that democratic liberal capitalism is a superior form of government that ultimately would triumph, all things being equal. The problem is it may be a very long time, and we have to live through the interim, and it's sort of, you know, we can get from the 1890s to the 1950s, but there's a lot of things that happen in between. So if it's 40 or 50 years before these forces finally emerge, there's a lot of history that can happen in 40 or 50 years. So from a sort of strategic point of view, I'm not sure that's all I'm saying is we can't bank on it. It looks to me like the autocracies, at least for the moment, have figured out how to pull this off for the next phase. Whether that changes, like, one can only hope.
Now, George Bush put spreading democracy and freedom at the center of American foreign policy. You pointed out that wasn't an entirely new American idea, and you wrote some essays yourself on the importance of that. How important is it now? How aggressive should the U.S. be in trying to undermine these autocracies?
Well, I think we should be, you know, in this respect, I don't think we should be less willing to do some of the things that we did do during the Cold War. I mean, when I hear that it's impossible for us to have any impact on what's going on in Russia, it reminds me of many of the same people think that the Helsinki Accords played a critical role in ultimately bringing down the Soviet Union. If you go in Europe in particular, that's the view. Well, I mean, is Putin really tougher than Brezhnev? I think that we ought not to be afraid of carrying on the same kinds of democracy promotion activities, not of a violent nature, but just the kind of same democracy promotion issue, even if they don't show any particular fruit, as the Helsinki Accords did not for some time. I think we should be willing to do it. But I also think that it's been a mistake, and even perhaps a strategic mistake. At each stage, Putin has sort of made one more little step in the direction of dismantling democratic processes. And I think at each stage, he kind of pauses to look and see what the reaction is going to be. And at each stage, there's been essentially no reaction. There's not been great worldwide protest at each slice of the salami, whether it comes to rejiggering the terms for opposition parties to serve in the parliament, or the way the governors are chosen, or people being thrown in jail, or newspapers being shut down because they talked about an affair that he wasn't having. And at each stage, there's kind of the only time it ever gets hot is if somebody gets assassinated in London. But otherwise, there's pretty much silence. I don't see why that should be the case. I mean, I know why it is the case, because we have a lot of fish to fry with Russia, and that isn't one of the ones that we want to fry. But I think that that's a strategic error, and that we have an interest in him not being able to consolidate as much as he would like. He fears not being able to consolidate as much as he would like, and we ought to help him be worried about it.
Finally, Stephen.
Stephen Stern, Washington, D.C. Jewish Community Center. Nuanced though your argument is, I keep hearing, and I haven't read the book, a certain return to bipolarity and thinking about U.S. role in that. Again, you can go back to 100 years in which the U.S. was either an indispensable nation or a nation on which other people were looking to or against to deal with, and then the Cold War era, very clear bipolarity, which sort of ended in strategic catastrophe, first by us, maybe in terms of Vietnam, and leading to the Russian strategic catastrophe of Afghanistan. And then there we are, standing alone and successfully leading a coalition as the indispensable power in the Gulf. And now, 15 years later, there we are in the Gulf again, and the term pitiful, helpless giant keeps coming back to me from an earlier era. I mean, when you talk about the world returning to a kind of bipolarity, are you completely comfortable with that and comfortable with the hardy perennials of what U.S. power is restoring itself in terms of leading or playing a collaborative role in that kind of a world?
Well, I really don't think I am going back to bipolarity. I mean, I'm talking about multiple great powers engaged in competition. I am drawing attention to the fact that instead of there just being one model of political and economic development, there does seem to be another model. I don't think that's an attempt at creating a bipolar world. I think it's an attempt at just describing what's going on. Now, what to do about that? If I say that democracies need to stand up for democracy, that's what you are objecting to. So I guess the question is, as opposed to what? What role should the United States play? There are alternatives. One alternative is, I don't think it's going to happen, but one alternative is the United States should really contract itself. It should not play the kind of strategic role that it now plays in East Asia, for instance. And there are those, and I've heard, especially in Europe, people say, why don't we just, why can't China run Asia? And why can't Russia have whatever sphere of influence it wants to have, and why are we in the Middle East? And that is an alternative. Quite honestly, I think if you aren't willing to go that route, then you're not going in a different direction. You can be smart or stupid in the conduct of your foreign policy. You could never get yourself into the wrong wars and only get yourself into the right wars. I'm sure people have a doctrine that can tell them how to do that. But the problem is that if you are in the business of doing any of that global role, you're going to be running up against these problems. You know, I'm always impressed because people look back and they say the containment strategy was incredibly successful, and then there was this awful Vietnam War. But of course, it was the containment strategy that got us in the Vietnam War. Maybe it was a misapplication of that strategy, but it certainly was that thinking. It was Dean Acheson's mindset, ultimately, that got us into the Vietnam War, which demonstrates how hard it is to have a right policy that never makes mistakes. And so I think we need to be more, you know, be realistic. I don't think it means that the United States has to fundamentally change its role. I mean, it means we should try to be smarter against all odds.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. That's an optimistic note.